You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I am Jeff Hayden. 3 months ago, on July 11th, we aired a show with the topic, "A nominee has been named to be the next justice to the United States Supreme Court. What is the process that comes next, and what difference does it make?" Tonight, we move on to part two. If you have questions for my guest, our phone number right here in the studio is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. If you're calling outside of the local dialing area, that's outside of San Francisco, please call us toll-free. Our toll-free number is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. My guest tonight is Dean Johnson. Dean is an Emmy-nominated commentator on both legal and political matters, as well as a practicing attorney. And our program this week will continue this discussion. New term, new court. The United States Supreme Court begins a new court year with a new justice. Dean Johnson, let me welcome you back to Your Legal Rights.
Well, thanks, Jeff. Glad to be here.
And again, our phone number to us, if you want to dial direct in the studio, 415-841-4134. Or if you're calling from outside of San Francisco, our toll-free number is 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. And I'd like to start here. Dean, at the start of this process some months back, seems to me you made some pretty bold predictions about the nomination process. And here we are. How did you fare in those predictions?
Well, we fared extremely well. If you go back to the transcripts of that program, you'll recall that I predicted Kavanaugh's confirmation by a vote of 50 to 49. The actual vote was 50 to 48 with Lisa Murkowski from Alaska voting present. She later announced that had she not voted present but rather voted on the confirmation itself, she would have voted no, so that would have made the vote 50 to 49, which is precisely what I predicted. More importantly and more significantly, we talked a lot in the last show in part one about the paradox that some of the senators faced in that, particularly for Democratic senators in red states facing close elections, that if they wanted, they had a choice. They had a trade-off. If they wanted to preserve the chances of Democrats taking over the Senate again and taking over the House, that even though their consciences might tell them otherwise, the rational move, the strategic move, would have been to vote yes on Kavanaugh. Those senators, the Dems in red states facing toss-up elections, didn't do so. And exactly as my model predicted, that has, I won't say cost the Democrats the Senate, but it has made the Senate a very, very long shot now. The changes in the voting polls in those senators' states, McCaskill in Missouri, Donnelly in Indiana, and especially Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota, the changes in the postures of their elections has been one of the reasons that the chances of the Democrats taking the Senate now have dropped from about 2-7 to 2-9, which is exactly what I would predict based on the numbers I was looking at. If you had asked me pre-Kavanaugh what the chances were of Democrats taking over the entire Congress, House and Senate, I would have answered about 24%. Tonight, the answer would be about 17%.
You know, I would like to ask you about a whole bunch of different arenas individually and kind of see where you what your thoughts are and where this goes.
Sure.
For example, let's talk about civil litigation for a moment. One of the big questions that people have been asking leading into the vote on Justice Kavanaugh is Roe versus Wade and what this means. What are your thoughts on Roe? Is Roe in danger?
I don't think Roe itself is in danger, but the word you always hear is chipping away. And that's sort of a vague, non-legal term. Being more specific, the battleground on Roe versus Wade and reproductive rights right now is what lawyers refer to as an undue burden. Cases come before the court where there has been some restriction placed, not a bar on abortion, but a restriction that makes abortion more difficult. For example, if a state were to pull funding from any hospital that provided abortions, that would be a burden on the right of abortion. And the questions before the court now are these undue burden questions. When is a burden reasonable and when is it not? In the past, the justices have been willing to consider these undue burden questions and in many cases strike down various legislative actions that put a burden on a woman's right to choose. There's a real question about whether now Justice Kavanaugh will do that. In the past, he has talked in dissenting opinions about what we call religious freedom, which sounds like a very good thing, but it does impact things like reproductive rights and which we'll talk about later, gay rights, because religious freedom says that there should be accommodations for faith-based claims, even where those claims contradict general public policy. So, for example, Justice Kavanaugh has said that a Catholic hospital run by priests can still receive federal funding even though it refuses to provide contraception or abortion, saying this is simply an accommodation to the priests and the Catholic institutions' religious freedom. And how far that goes is a real question, and it's one of the areas, one of the few areas, I think, where Kavanaugh will make a real difference. That being said, there are no Roe versus Wade type cases on the horizon. Justice Kavanaugh and the rest of the court will not hear any of those cases this term, probably not next term. What will happen maybe 2 years or more down the road is we'll see state legislatures enacting various types of measures that will place burdens on a woman's right to choose, in those cases eventually making their way up to the Supreme Court. And at that point, I think we're going to see just how far Kavanaugh's concepts of religious freedom extend and how much he believes that, as he told the Senate, that Roe versus Wade is a precedent that has been sustained by the court many, many times and therefore entitled to great weight under the doctrine of stare decisis or precedent.
Which for folks that are listening in the outside the studio that are non-lawyers, when we talk about stare decisis, we talk about the idea that an older case should control what comes after it so that the law is steady and dependable and we don't make bad decisions because we're relying on a law that whimsically gets changed when the politics of the day change.
Yeah, exactly. As Alan Dershowitz once said, law is the only profession where you're actually rewarded for showing that lots and lots and lots of people before you have thought of the same idea. And if courts have said the same thing over and over and over again for many years, the chances are if you say the same thing again, you're going to win. And the more the idea is, the more a case is cited. And the longer the period of time that a case is cited, the more it becomes set in concrete as part of the court's jurisprudence. And of course, Roe versus Wade has been cited time and time and time again. And more importantly, it's become embedded in our culture and our politics. This is a harsh way to phrase it, but people take reproductive rights for granted. We assume that women are going to have those rights. And to change that, to go back and restrict those rights or take them away by judicial fiat, would be something that would cause, obviously, a great deal of strife in our society. It would take us back to an era that none of us want to remember. And do courts look at that? Justice Kavanaugh said, you know, political considerations don't enter into my decisions, but trust me, they do. I mean, it's the Supreme Court and the justices are very much aware of cultural changes in the society and of the need of their institution to fit their decisions to culture as it is, gay rights being being an example. Justice Kennedy, when he began the road towards Obergefell, said, you know what, our previous decisions, and there had been many on issues involving gay relationships, just really didn't take into account the changes in culture that have occurred. And he said that 1 year, and about 5 years later, we have same-sex marriage as a fundamental constitutional right.
Let's pass on that because I want to ask about that later.
Sure, of course, yeah.
One of the things I did want to ask you is about criminal law. And there are certain things that we all take for granted. We look at a case such as Roe versus Wade and we think that was really almost the beginning of history. And we look at some of the fundamental rights that we enjoy in a criminal proceeding that only go back a few years before Roe. If you go back 10 years before Roe, there was no federal precedent on things such as your right to a lawyer or your right to post-arrest silence, being told about your right to post-arrest silence, such as the Miranda rule. So I guess my question for you is let's switch gears and talk about the criminal context. Do you think any of these things are in jeopardy? Given a more conservative court, will they possibly reverse some of these fundamental rights that, at least on a federal level, have only been protected nationwide since the mid-60s? Do you think there's any jeopardy to the right to an attorney, for example?
No, I don't think so. What we're talking about here and what you're talking about is what I sometimes call paradigm shift, that even though the court is very reluctant to change the way it approaches cases, there come times when the court just wholesale changes the way that it looks at a particular area of law. One of the great paradigm shifts was what we call the Earl Warren Revolution, where Chief Justice Warren, who was supposed to take the bench as a conservative justice, actually took the bench and became what was regarded as one of the most liberal justices of all time and completely changed the way the court approached criminal procedure. And massively, universally broadened the notion of procedural rights for criminal defendants. That paradigm is still solidly in place, and I don't see that going away. I don't see things like the exclusionary rule or the Miranda decision going away. That being said,
And by the exclusionary rule, to those, again, non-attorneys that are listening, that, and we're going to talk about the Fourth Amendment in a minute, but in general, if the Fourth Amendment is violated, there is a strong likelihood that the defendant would seek and very possibly attain the exclusion of illegally seized evidence. And that was meant to deter that conduct. And it's not meant to strictly benefit the person charged, but rather it's the protection that the rest of us have as opposed to what would otherwise take place if there was no remedy. And we told the police we're just trusting you not to enter your house when they're not supposed to be there.
Yeah, the exclusionary rule is something that drives conservatives crazy. The notion that concededly relevant evidence may be excluded from court because the police did something wrong. But during the Warren Revolution, the court examined all of the various alternatives for deterring police misconduct and violation of constitutional rights, like the right to avoid unreasonable search and seizure. And they said this is the only thing that works. And it has worked, and it's worked very well. We don't see, for example, the backroom confessions with the rubber hose beatings that we saw before those rights were in place. I don't see that changing. What I do see is that there are many frontiers for defendants' rights, particularly in the areas of communication. You know, we recently had a case discussing whether or not a search warrant was necessary to go into someone's cell phone. Privacy rights like that are still very much up in the air. I would suspect that Justice Kavanaugh, much like Justice Kennedy, would be reluctant to extend the requirement of a search warrant to various, you know, various electronic devices, various areas of privacy that are yet unexplored. But I think the fundamental, the bedrock notion of defendants' rights is going to stay in place. Again, it's going to be very much like Roe versus Wade. There may be some chipping away, or more accurately, a refusal to expand rights, but I don't see those rights going away.
And we'll return to that in just a moment, because that was the next topic I wanted to discuss, was the electronics. But again, for our listeners, our phone number to us in the studio is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. If you're calling from outside of the San Francisco area, please call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. Once again, that number is 866-798-8255. And we talked about the right to an attorney. That's probably not going to change. That, of course, is Gideon v. Wainwright. We talked about the case that really protects our post-arrest silence. That's Miranda v. Arizona. But there's a lot of Fourth Amendment stuff that differs a lot from what could have been foreseen at the time that the Constitution was drafted. So when you talk about somebody whose idea of how to reason these cases is grounded in the framers' intent, how do you circle back to something like a cell phone or a little computer? California reasoned it in a case called People versus Diaz, where Mr. Diaz had been arrested, he'd been detained for quite a while, and they actually went into his cell phone without a warrant, without his permission, and extracted information that related possibly to drug dealing, and went all the way to the California Supreme Court. This goes back 8 years. It was January of 2009, the same day that all of our constitutional officers for California were being sworn in, and the Supreme Court slipped out this little decision that went largely unnoticed, that basically said, well, he had it with him when he was arrested, and after all, they needed the information. And that was a law in California for a few years. And a similar case made it to the United States Supreme Court. And the federal courts had already been working on this doctrine that in considering this, the amount of privacy and the fact that someone had the electronics with them may not be dispositive, because you have so much information that's kept in these areas. And the U.S. Supreme Court, and it's only been a few years, maybe 5 years, came out in a case called Riley versus California and said, not so fast. You can't go into those things without either a search warrant, permission, or maybe a probation condition that somebody's given up a Fourth Amendment right. What do you think about a case like Riley? Do you think that that's not a really old case? Do you think that that might be chipped away at by this new court?
No, I think it that kind of case is going to stay. The court was pretty strong in Riley in talking about the importance of a cell phone and the importance of it to privacy rights. I think one of the taglines was the court said in essence, look, the Fourth Amendment specifically protects the home. We can't think of anything that would be a greater invasion of privacy than going into the home, other than maybe going into your cell phone. Because if you go into the cell phone, you're going to find things that you can't even find in somebody's home. You're going to find medical records. You're going to find telephone records. You're going to find private communications about the most intimate things. You're going to find the person's reading history, his internet search history, and so on and so forth. I don't think those things are going to go away. But rather than talking about specific doctrines, you know, I'm very much a big picture guy. And I think listeners are wondering, you know, how much difference is Kavanaugh going to make? You can't turn on any news station today without talking about, oh, now that Justice Kavanaugh is sitting on the bench, this is going to be horrible. We have another institution that's compromised. Now our legislature, our White House, and our courts are compromised. Roe versus Wade is going to go away. All of our rights are going to. And so I was curious to do a little statistical survey on my own.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't it just a few years ago we had this same conversation on the airwaves when Justice O'Connor retired and
sure.
was replaced by a conservative? And it's hasn't that been pretty much the rolling doctrine?
And we had the same same discussion when Justice Gorsuch was confirmed. But what I thought I might do is go over some of the more significant cases that have been decided post-Gorsuch confirmation and before Justice Kennedy retired. In other words, when the court was fully staffed with all nine justices, we can look at those decisions and we can say to ourselves, what would have happened given the spread and given how the court came out? What would have happened if we took out Justice Kennedy and we put in Justice Kavanaugh? And the answer is it's pretty clear that it would have made little or no difference. In fact, in those 15 cases, it would have made no difference whatsoever. So for those listeners who didn't care for Justice Kavanaugh, who thought he was a bad appointment, the message would be, don't panic. For those of you who thought Justice Kavanaugh was the greatest thing since sliced bread and was a brilliant appointment, don't pop the champagne corks just yet. The Supreme Court as an institution works very slowly. It works generally incrementally. It's a passive institution in that it can only decide the cases that come before it and that it wants to, that it chooses to decide. And we typically, you know, we remember Justice Kennedy fondly, I think, because of Obergefell, which we discussed earlier, the same-sex marriage case. We remember Kennedy as something of a liberal, as the swing vote who was sometimes on the liberal side. But that's not really accurate. Justice Kennedy was quite a conservative. He, like Justice Kavanaugh, was very pro-business. He had questions about reproductive rights, questions about immigration rights. So the Kavanaugh Court, if that's a proper term, is not going to be a whole lot different from the Kennedy Court. There are a few areas where they may be different. One area we've talked about, we've touched on a little bit already, the area of religious freedom, which I think may become significant. But to expect sudden changes or to expect that the right of privacy is going to disappear or that defendants' rights, as articulated by the Warren Court, are going to disappear or be significantly taken away all of a sudden, that's just not going to happen. The other thing to think about is that, and I've had interns who became Supreme Court clerks, and I know that when you become a Supreme Court clerk, regardless of your ideology going in, you learn a lot about how the court functions and how you should function within the court from your justice. Justices are very, very much mentors of their clerks. And Justice Kavanaugh clerked, as did Justice Gorsuch, for Justice Kennedy. So I suspect his approach is going to be very much like Kennedy's, and I think the court is going to stay the same with certain exceptions that we can talk about.
The last time we were here, and I see a call's on its way to us,
sure.
But the last time that we were here, we were discussing whether the court was truly shifting to the right and who, if anybody, is left as a swing vote. You espoused a theory on that, if you'd like to refresh us on that.
Sure. We talked about what's known in voting behavior as the median voter theorem, which says essentially the guy in the middle almost always gets his way. If you have if you have nine people voting on a proposition, four swing one way and four swing the other, the guy who takes the middle position is the deciding vote. In the Kennedy era, Kennedy was traditionally that deciding vote. Now, if you look at the histories of the various justices, Justice Roberts now becomes the median voter, the center guy. So in a very real sense, this becomes the Roberts Court. Typically, you refer to a court as, you know, by its chief justice. So when Rehnquist was chief justice, it was the Rehnquist Court. Earl Warren had the Warren Court. This has always been the Roberts Court because he's chief justice. But now in a very pragmatic way, it is Justice Roberts Court because he holds the swing vote. That swing vote is somewhat to the right of Justice Kennedy. So in a sense, the whole court shifts to the right. But as Chief Justice, he not only holds the power of the swing vote, but he holds the powers of Chief Justice, the ability to decide whether he is going to write the majority opinion or he'll assign it out to somebody else, which dictates how broad the decision is going to be, whether it'll reach certain issues and so on.
And, of course, that presumes that he's on the majority, because if he's on the minority, that would fall to the senior most justice.
Absolutely.
Let me interrupt you just there. Yeah. We have a call coming in. Nancy from Berkeley, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hey, Nancy.
Nancy, are you still with us?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Nancy. You're on the air. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you. I wanted to ask your guest... he said that because, or at least if I'm interpreting right, that senators like Heidi Heitkamp and Claire McCaskill voted for Kavanaugh, that they're going to lose their Senate seats. But what makes him think that they were going to win the election anyways? I mean, you know, they depend on Democrats, and Democrats are going to vote for them no matter what. So I don't understand that if they voted for Kavanaugh, all of a sudden they're going to accumulate all these votes.
No, actually, what I said was that because they voted against Kavanaugh, they voted against Kavanaugh.
Right.
It's funny. If you were listening, I was talking about what we call the median voter theorem. The same idea applies to senatorial elections. And when you have a Democratic candidate with a largely Republican constituency, as you do in those cases, and the election, at least statistically, is very, very close, the way those candidates act on a high-profile, very salient, very controversial issue like the appointment of Justice Kavanaugh or the confirmation of Justice Kavanaugh can really shift the election one way or the other. If you're an incumbent with a solid seat, it's not going to make a lot of difference. But if your election is a toss-up, as were those three elections, then your decision on one issue like this can shift it from a toss-up to a possible or even a probable loss. And in fact, that's what's happened in the approximately 1 week since the vote occurred.
I don't understand if they had voted, you know, for Kavanaugh, you think all these Republicans were then going to vote for them? And if they had voted for him, I think they would have lost a lot of Democrat votes.
No, actually not. The Democrats who were going to vote for them would vote for them anyway. But you would pick up a number of votes as you move towards the center. Bill Clinton was actually a master of this strategy. When he was seeking the presidential nomination, he was way out to the left. But as soon as he got the nomination, he moves towards the center to seize upon some of those voters at the center and to the right of where he was previously. And it's just the math works out beautifully. And sometimes I would rather do this on TV because I can show you exactly how it works. But the facts speak for themselves. The probability of Democrats taking the Senate have dropped from about 2-7 to 2-9, which is about 22%.
Well, do you think that Joe Manson, because he voted for Kavanaugh, is going to win his seat?
He was rated as a probable win anyway. His election was rated as leaning Democratic, but he certainly enhanced his chances now.
Yeah, I don't know if, as a Democrat, I don't know if I would have voted for anybody who voted for Kavanaugh.
Nancy, I'm going to ask you to hold that thought. We need to stop for break for just a moment.
Okay.
But you're welcome
to
stay on the line. We won't be gone for more than a few seconds. Pam, I know you're on the line. Please stay with us for just a moment. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW-FM, and we'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
Nancy, are you still with us?
Yes.
Let me say something. I'm going to take what Dean's been saying and say it in slightly different terms so that for people that are having a little difficulty conceptualizing what he's saying, it may make it a little easier from a second viewpoint. One of the things that we sometimes refer to in sizing up defenses for cases or the like is the idea of a fulcrum. It's the point at which something is balanced. And what Dean was saying is that if you are a senator facing re-election, and you are in a state where your voters tend to be from the opposite party and perhaps a different ideology, but you're still leading them, you've still been there, and it's a fairly close call. He's simply saying that taking a position on a singular large issue, whatever it is, may shift that balance point so that the centrist voters, the ones that switch sides, the ones that aren't necessarily aligned with the other side, their loyalties may shift a little bit for or against the position you take.
Well, you know, maybe those voters in the middle, maybe they were anti-Kavanaugh, and maybe they will vote for, like, Claire McCaskill.
Well, think about it this way, Nancy. Let's suppose you're a Democrat, yes?
Yes.
Okay. Let's suppose you're in West Virginia, and now you have the choice. Huh?
God forbid.
Actually, it's a beautiful place. I've been there.
I'm only kidding.
And there's some very nice people there.
I'm sure there are.
One of whom is Joe Manchin. But think about it this way. Think about now you're in a position where you have Joe Manchin, whom you disagree with on one issue, namely the Kavanaugh confirmation. But out there, way to the right of Joe Manchin and way to the right of you, is the Republican candidate. Which do you prefer?
I might write somebody in.
Okay.
Nancy,
I guess I'm one of these people. I mean, I think that Lisa Murkowski should get a hero's parade. I think she was just absolutely wonderful. And I think it's very important to vote the right way and to vote your conscience.
Yeah, well, you know, it is, and I'm not saying that the three that I've named were wrong in doing that. What I'm saying is that politics is a ruthless game,
yeah,
where you play strategically or you don't play at all. And if you don't play strategically, there are lots of people with lots of money who are very hungry for lots of power who will make sure that when you make a mistake, you pay for it. And when you do that, if you vote your conscience as opposed to voting what your constituency believes and wants, you may wind up with a chapter in Profiles in Courage, but you may also lose your job. And historically, that's what's happened.
Right.
And Nancy, we are in a republic, and all of the millions of people in California have two people that are casting our votes for us, and in essence, they're our proxy. So if they decided that their conscience called for them to go in a very different direction than the rest of the state doesn't necessarily want them answering for us or standing up for us anymore because they're doing something different. But that's
happens.
The theory.
I mean, that happened at the Democratic Convention when Bernie Sanders actually won a lot of states. And when these delegates got to the convention, they just voted for Hillary Clinton, even though their states went for Bernie. So
yep.
That's a whole different discussion
I'd
love to have with you sometime. But
okay.
Nancy, thank you for joining us. It's been a pleasure having you on Your Legal Rights.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Nancy. Thanks for calling in.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW-FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I am Jeff Hayden. With me in the studio tonight is Dean Johnson, an Emmy-nominated commentator on both legal and political matters, as well as a practicing attorney. Our program this week, New Term, New Court, as the United States Supreme Court begins a new year with a new justice. Our phone number to us in the studio is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. If you're calling from outside of San Francisco, please call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Pam from San Mateo, I hope you're still with us. You've been very patient. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Well, thanks very much, Jeff. I have a question about the religious freedom ideas that Dean was talking about. And my question is about, is that really all religious rights, or is that pretty much what I will call narrowly Christian rights? Because it seems to me that at least the cases that I've heard of tend to be about, medical people who don't want to get involved in birth control or abortion, or they're about people who don't want to bake cakes for a gay wedding or something of that sort. And I'm wondering, does it extend beyond that? Have there been cases about, like, Jewish rights or Muslim rights? Or if I really want to go far out, like maybe even Wiccan rights, if, you know, if somebody is practicing Wiccan, are their rights actually going to be respected under this sort of religious freedom idea?
You know, that's a great question, and I'm going to give you kind of a long answer. There's a federal statute called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and it began with, it was actually drafted by Democrats, most notably Chuck Schumer, and another version was drafted by Ted Kennedy. And the original intent of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act was to protect Native American religious rights. There were several instances where various land policies promulgated by the federal government restricted the ability of Native Americans to perform certain religious ceremonies on what they considered sacred ground. And so Democrats proposed a Religious Freedom Restoration Act that would allow these Native Americans, despite the fact that broad public policy said that people couldn't go on these lands or couldn't use these lands, they would be allowed to go on for religious purposes if they had a good faith religious claim. That was the original intent. That act was passed almost unanimously by both the Senate and by the House of Representatives. It has since been invoked for all sorts of different religions, from cults that use peyote and smoke marijuana as part of religious ceremonies, to, as you mentioned, the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, where a cake maker, a baker, refused to make a wedding cake for a same-sex couple. And it has kind of a convoluted history in the Supreme Court, the Religious Freedom Act does. It does not apply to the states and to state law. It applies only to federal law. However, the states liked it so much that most states have now enacted state religious freedom laws. The question is, does this notion of religious freedom, the idea that even though there's a broad public policy or a law that says you can't do something like discriminate, does the notion of religious freedom have a constitutional dimension so that people who, like the baker, who didn't want to serve same-sex couples, does he have a religious claim that sounds in constitutional law? Thus far, the Supreme Court has either said no, or as in the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, they've punted and said we're going to kick this back to the states and let them decide. There is indication that Justice Kavanaugh has a very strong view of the notion of religious freedom and believes that the religious freedom that's now only a matter of statute is also a matter of constitutional rights. So he would say, yes, if you're a baker and you don't want to serve same-sex couples, you don't have to. If you are a hotel owner and you want to discriminate against Muslims or Jews or gay couples based on your religious views, you can do that, even though there's a famous case called Heart of Atlanta that says that such facilities cannot discriminate. And there are a couple of decisions that Justice Kavanaugh has made that suggest that he believes that that accommodation needs to be made. There are also several cases that are coming up before the court, one involving a florist who refused to serve a same-sex couple and some others that may bubble up and may give us an indication. And this is an area where I think Justice Kavanaugh's vote may make a difference, and he may very well find companions to follow along with him on the right side of the Supreme Court bench. Was that way more information than you wanted about that?
Actually, it's not. So let me give you a couple of hypotheticals and let me play with those a little bit.
Okay, you play judge and give me hypotheticals.
Okay, right. So suppose you're a Mormon and so you do not drink alcohol. Is it okay for you to work in a bar and refuse to serve the patrons alcohol even though you're a cocktail waitress? okay.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I'll go there. Uh-huh. And suppose that you're being a little more serious but still kind of facetious.
Uh-huh.
If you're a Buddhist, and so you don't eat beef.
Yeah.
Sorry, a Hindu and you don't eat beef.
Yeah.
Is it okay if you work in a barbecue place and you're not going to serve the patrons beef?
Well, that's the question. And I think, you know, your hypotheticals indicate the problem with this concept of religious freedom. It's so capacious that it can include anything. You could claim that you're the church of fast drivers, and so your religion dictates that you drive more than 100 miles an hour. Are you therefore exempt from the speed limits? I mean, you could multiply absurd examples, as Justice Scalia used to say, until the cows come home. I think it's a very problematic area, and I think it would be extremely difficult to develop a coherent jurisprudence based on this notion of religious freedom. I mean, it's one of those cases of unintended consequences of legislation. The original purpose was very salutary. It was to protect the sacred burial grounds of Native Americans and their religious rights, but it has expanded into something far beyond what the original legislators intended and may go even further.
Okay. So pun fully intended, it's mushrooms.
it certainly has. It's exploded, and we're just waiting to see if it explodes and you know, washes over a lot of jurisprudence. I mean, the concern here is obviously that the notion of religious freedom interfaces with notions like reproductive rights. Justice Kavanaugh, for example, has said, and I think I mentioned this, that a Catholic hospital can, based on claims of religious freedom, can refuse to provide contraceptions and abortions and still obtain federal funding. Mm-hmm. So, you know, how far does that go?
Yeah, that's a good question. Thank you very much. Really good discussion.
Yeah,
Pam,
absolutely.
Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
David from Berkeley, Jonathan from Oakland, you're on the air. Bear with me just a moment. I do have one listener question that was called into us rather than coming on the air. But this listener is saying what she is concerned about concerning Justice Kavanaugh was his opening remarks and how partisan and angry he was. And, of course, mm-hmm. we're going back to the second portion of the nomination hearings where he spoke after Professor Ford. And his words, this whole two-week effort has been a calculated and orchestrated political hit fueled with apparent pent-up anger about President Trump and the 2016 election, fear that he's been unfairly stoked about his judicial record, revenge on behalf of the Clintons, and millions of dollars in money from outside left-wing opposition groups. A number of law school professors have also expressed alarm that then-Judge Kavanaugh, now Justice Kavanaugh, was no longer a so-called neutral umpire calling balls and strikes, and that based on his remarks, he was not displaying the requisite judicial temperament to sit on the Supreme Court. Lawrence Tribe commented that his personal attacks on Senate members and his partisan tirades do more than simply display a striking, injudicious temperament. They disqualify him from participating in a wide range of the cases that may come before the Supreme Court, cases involving individuals or groups that Justice Kavanaugh has now singled out. I guess this listener wants you to tell us your response to all this. Do you think that he can be that neutral umpire? Do you think that he should be or could be recused for some of these cases?
Well, there are always cases where a justice can be recused. But as I see it, there are a couple of different questions there. First of all, is he a neutral umpire? And the answer is no. No justice is a neutral umpire. Every justice comes to the bench with a certain ideological preference, with a certain notion of jurisprudence, the importance of precedent, and so on. So they all bring baggage to the bench. The other question that's always raised is Justice Kavanaugh, does he have the demeanor of a judge? And I have to say that I was appalled by the display at the Senate confirmation hearings. I mean, even if you're going, this was a job interview, and even if you're going to interview for a job flipping burgers, if the interview starts with, you know, I really like beer, I drink beer, and sometimes I drink too much beer, chances are you aren't going to get the job. And I remember there's an old saying, when you wanted to describe somebody who was very sober and had his wits about him, you described the person as being sober as a judge. And the implication there is that sobriety and patience and calmness and equanimity are all part of a judge's toolbox, and the judge should exercise those. I think Justice Kavanaugh may have a hard time doing that. On the other hand, he's managed to sit now for several years on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeal, which is considered the second most important court in the nation, and he's managed to survive as a judge without any sort of behavioral problems. I think he's able to keep it together on the bench. How he does back in chambers, how he does in the conference room with the other justices, we don't know, but I sort of have the feeling that Ruth Bader Ginsburg and the others on the court can hold their own against him. So, I think the display was awful and says bad things about the bench, I think he probably can survive on the bench. And even if his demeanor's not that great, Jeff and I both know that often we encounter judges whose demeanors are not perfect. I mean, both of us in our many years of experience have encountered tirades from judges, irascible judges, angry judges, indifferent judges. So that happens. I don't think that's necessarily going to be a problem, even though, you know, you worry about somebody who comes to a job interview and talks about how he loves beer.
Hopefully, his breath didn't smell from beer.
Well, let's hope he had a Tic Tac or something before he came in, and also the notion that he buys into conspiracy theories, and especially when he buys into conspiracy theories when a woman like Dr. Ford is testifying about something that obviously happened to her. I mean, that accusation that somehow somebody like Dr. Ford would come before not just the Senate Judiciary Committee, but before the whole world and under penalty of perjury testify to something that happened to her, and that she is somehow a pawn in some giant conspiracy, I think it is very disturbing, and there's a lot about that mentality that does disturb me.
And with that, David from Berkeley, welcome. You're on Your Legal Rights.
Yes, thank you very much. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Hi, David.
So, since you started the program with an assessment of your predictions regarding the nomination, I would like to have you consider a prediction that I recently made. But first of all, I should say that I loved your example of the Church of Fast Driving with respect to religious liberty. I am a member of that organization myself, and I believe in scrupulously obeying all motor vehicle laws, with the possible exception of the artificially low speed limits.
Well, you might want to repent from that, David.
That's possible.
Yeah.
Here's my prediction, that within a couple of years, with regard to reproductive rights, there will be at least 20 states in which there is only one or no abortion clinics operating as a result of restrictions placed by the states that will be upheld by the Supreme Court. That's my prediction. Your comments.
You know, I don't see that necessarily happening. I think there is going to be some life to what we call the undue burden notion, and that if, say, a state shuts down all of the institutions that would provide abortion, would allow a woman to exercise her right to choose, I think that's going to be seen by any justice as an undue burden. And even if Justice Kavanaugh and a few others might disagree, I think that's one where we will see a coalition form that it can at least strike down those laws. There will be other types of restrictions that are more subtle and more borderline that will place burdens on the right to choose, and whether those will survive or not, it's as Yogi Berra might say, it's too early to speculate. We have to see exactly where Kavanaugh stands. Gorsuch is also a kind of a wild card in that whole equation. So we'll see what kind of track record they establish. But I do think that there are going to be now there are people in state legislatures who see an opportunity and an opening. And we sometimes use the term test case for constitutional cases. There are going to be a lot of people out there who are going to pass legislation just to create the test case and get it up to the Supreme Court and see how much they can chip away at Roe versus Wade.
Thank you.
Sure.
Jonathan from Oakland, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you. I have a couple questions about the Senate confirmation process.
Mm-hmm.
I've watched a number of them, and especially Roberts and this current one, where they don't seem to ask questions that get to, let's say, the ideology, the hidden ideology of the justice who's up for a job. And in this last one, Kavanaugh seemed, you know, so erudite, at least to me. He seemed well, you know, educated, and he had a good memory. He knew the president. He kind of knew what to say until something kind of irrational erupted in him. But so I'm wondering if there's a way to, if your guest has, would think of, you know, himself might have ways to learn more where these men are really at. And then if I could shoehorn in another question about this, it seems to me what isn't examined is this the religious liberty combined with corporate power that seems to be creeping into our society. And those are my questions.
Yeah, well, as far as the hearings, you have to remember, I said at the beginning of the program that politics is largely a game. When you watch these, don't think of them as a truth-finding process. Think of them as part of the game. The questioners, the senators, are playing a game because this is a giant photo op for them. Most of the time, their questions are not questions, they're speeches. And their target audience is obviously their constituency, because they want their constituency to see their senator expressing their views, and they really don't care what the answer is. There are also other restrictions, because a candidate for a seat on the Supreme Court is restricted in some ways. He or she simply cannot comment on cases that may be pending in the federal system, or that he or she may have decided or may be asked to decide. So they have to decline answers on certain questions, and the senators know this, and they will avoid going into some of those areas. As far as Justice Kavanaugh being smart, there is no question that on paper he is eminently qualified to be a justice. I think the issue was never, does he have the paper qualifications? Is his resume good enough? It clearly is. The question is, given that he has that good resume, is he the kind of person that we would want sitting in the most important court on the planet, a court where with the stroke of a pen he could literally change the culture of the United States? And some people said no, and some people maybe have said yes, and other people have said, you know what, this is all politics and we really don't care. Now, what was your other question?
Oh, it had to be where it seems like, for instance, where these large hospitals run by religious organizations are actually corporations. And so there seems to be this synthesis of religious liberty and increasing corporate power.
Yeah, both go together. There are certainly accommodations for religious institutions or religious-run institutions, and I think I can see where that jurisprudence is going, in that the justices may say, you know, it's much harder for an institution to pretend to be faith-based than for a person to pretend to be faith-based. An institution, if it's a Catholic hospital or a Jewish hospital or, a Christian hospital or a Christian school, it has as its institutional charter certain religious parameters, whereas individuals can just make it up as they go along. There may be a space for accommodation of religious preferences of institutions. But you raise a larger question, which is this whole role of corporate power in the exercise of rights. And I think where that becomes important is the role of corporate power in First Amendment jurisprudence. For example, corporate free speech. Justice Kennedy was the author of Citizens United, which said that corporations are people too. Their First Amendment rights are fungible with those of individuals. And this is an area that's very close to my own heart, because back in 1979, I actually wrote a law review article talking about corporate free speech, and I said this is an issue that the court must face, the issue of the relationship between power and how power can distort the marketplace of ideas as well as the economic marketplace. That's an issue that this court will undoubtedly take up in several contexts.
Jonathan, I'm sorry, but we are out of town, but I want to thank you for joining us on Your Legal Rights.
Thank you.
And Dean, before we go off the air, I wanted to give you a minute or so if there's any last thoughts you have before we close out.
Yeah, I repeat what I said before. Don't panic. And if you like Justice Kavanaugh and you like the new composition of the Supreme Court, don't pop your champagne corks yet. The Supreme Court is a venerable institution. It works slowly. It's constrained by rules like the rules of precedent, and it's limited in what it can do. So don't expect to see everybody's rights disappear right away. There may be some chipping away at the edges, but our fundamental constitutional structures, I think, will remain intact for quite some time.
And with that, I will thank you all for listening. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. Our topic tonight has been New Term, New Court. The United States Supreme Court begins a new year with a new justice. My guest tonight has been Emmy-nominated legal and political analyst and Redwood City attorney Dean Johnson. Thank you once again for joining us.
Thanks, Jeff.
We'll be back next week at this time with Your Legal Rights, and later this month, we'll be once again operating our Call a Lawyer feature right here at KALW. Again, you're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. Our thanks to you for listening, to our production assistant, Martin McLean, and at the controls, Joanne Marr. I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.